Please welcome Dr. Rebecca Vasquez. Dr. Vasquez is an associate professor in the Department of Dermatology at UT Southwestern Medical Center. She is an American Board of Dermatology certified general dermatologist with an interest in all things related to the skin. Although she's a dermatologist by day, at night, she's a Tejano karaoke singer and a huge fan of all things Selena.
Hi, everyone. Can you hear me okay? Yeah? I'm not used to this setup, so bear with me here. Thanks so much for that kind introduction. I think we'll go ahead and get started because we have a lot to cover, but it's a pleasure to be with you today. We're gonna do a quick tour of a differential diagnosis for hyperpigmentation disorders, followed by another quick tour of hypo or even depigmentation disorders. So I hope we'll get to learn some nice clinical pearls that you can take with you. So with that, we'll go ahead and get started. Let's see here. All right, so the objectives are we want to be able to identify diagnostic clues that differentiate between common pigmentary disorders. We're also going to talk a little bit about the treatment plan. And then I also want to just spend a couple of minutes defining colorism, because when we talk a lot about we're going to talk a little bit about skin lightening treatments, and I think it's important to sort of discuss that there are instances where you'll find patients who are looking just for medications to really lighten the overall skin. We have to ask ourselves why that is and sort of prepare ourselves to have a discussion about that. So that'll be at the very end. So we'll start with two cases. The first is a 65-year-old man consults you because of a six-month duration of white spots on his neck, chest, and arms. And it's been more noticeable in the summer, and he thinks it's getting worse. He presents to you for evaluation and treatment. So I'm going to show you two photos. I don't know that we have the automated response system, but we'll just kind of do it old school. Maybe raise some hands if y'all are willing to work with me here, okay? But this patient comes to you, and he's got what looks like maybe depigmentation in some areas, maybe even some hypopigmentation in some areas. We see the back of the neck. This looks a little bit more depigmented, right? So the distribution kind of more in photo-exposed areas. So what you should be thinking is of all of these conditions. So we've got cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, non-segmental vitiligo, tinea versicolor, melanoma-associated leukoderma or vitiligo, and the other one is idiopathic guttate hypomelanosis. So I want you to kind of think about, we won't go over the answer quite yet, but we're going to go through a differential, and at the end we'll sort of figure out what is the diagnosis. So again, these are all conditions that are different, okay? All of these conditions, these are both hypopigmentation and depigmentation disorders, they're all different. So we'll go over each one of them and talk a little bit about how we make the diagnosis or how we can sort of delineate between these diagnoses. So the first is showing the torso. We see more what I would call depigmented patches, maybe some macules. What is the diagnosis? If you guessed non-segmental vitiligo, you would be correct. So non-segmental vitiligo is probably present anywhere between 1% and 2% of the general population. It may appear shortly after birth, but more often it occurs in young adults around 20 years of age. This is important because that's gonna help us sort of decipher against some of the other diagnoses, so keep that in mind. There's also usually a history of Kebner phenomenon. So in areas of repetitive trauma, around the eyes, sometimes around the mouth, along the wrist, you'll usually find symmetric depigmented areas in those places. And there is usually a family history in first degree relatives. About 10% of patients may say, oh yeah, I have an uncle or a sibling that also has similar skin changes. So what is this diagnosis? So it's not obviously depigmented, but it's also on photo-exposed areas, and maybe it looks a little bit more hypopigmented. So if you guess tinea versicolor, that would be correct. So tinea versicolor, depending on one's skin complexion, may look more pink to scaly, or it can look more hypopigmented and scaly. I've also seen this present more hyperpigmented in some instances. The majority of cases tend to be asymptomatic, but if there are symptoms, usually it'll be maybe it's itchy here and there. But for the most part, it's something that becomes noticeable in the summer for two reasons. In the summer is when we get a little bit more hot, humid, and sweaty, so this is kind of the time where it tends to come up. But also, the normal skin will tan, and so these areas become a little bit more obvious, and that's when patients may come to you and say, hey, I have something going on, I'm not sure what it is. The treatment, sometimes all we do in our clinic is Nizoral, depending on if it's pretty mild presentation. But you can also add, if it's pretty bad, generalized involvement, the patient's bothered by it, you can also do a dose of fluconazole. I usually like to do 150 milligrams for 1 week and then repeat it another week. And then I'll have them do the shampoo two or three times a week as maintenance. And then just kind of reassure that these things tend to happen, so, you know, don't be too alarmed. So what we're seeing here is, again, do we think this is more hypopigmentation, depigmentation? I would say this is more hypopigmentation, okay? And what we're seeing is it's not just in areas of sun exposure, but it's actually in sun-protected areas. So if you think this is CTCL or hypopigmented MF, you would be correct, okay? So this condition often gets misdiagnosed as tinea versicolor, especially because it's more common in adolescents, okay? So the other name for this is mycosis fungoides. So this is often thought to be an early stage of CTCL or cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. And what you'll see is it's very easy to think that this could be tinea versicolor, right, given the distribution. So this patient actually came, I actually staff a free clinic on Saturdays, once a month on Saturday. So this patient actually came for a totally different reason. He was seen in the ER and he had what was an irritated skin tag on his thigh. We don't normally do those types of biopsies in the ER, so they referred him to our free clinic. And when we sort of lifted or pulled down his pants to take a look at the skin tag, we saw all these hypopigmented spots, and I was like, hey, what's going on? How long has this been going on? And they were like, oh, this is tinea versicolor. So we were able to make the diagnosis of CTCL. Usually this is more often occurring in adolescent or children. The great news is it has a really good prognosis. So you can treat this with topical steroids and phototherapy, and it has a great prognosis. But it is more often something that we see, maybe because it's more obvious in patients with darker skin tones. Interestingly enough, there was a relatively recent retrospective study that sort of found that for patients who had, whether it was solitary findings of hypopigmentation or if they had a mixed hyperpigmented and hypopigmented, it actually those patients tended to do better. So that could be a good prognostic sign for your patients. But what I wanted to show is, depending on one's skin type, CTCL can look very different, right? So what we see in lighter skin types, you might see a little bit more of that pink color, but in more deeply pigmented skin, we see a mix of both. You can see a mix of both hypopigmentation and hyperpigmentation. So what is the diagnosis here? This is showing more, I would say, photo-accentuated areas. Why do I say that? Whenever I see solar lentigos, right, to me that's a marker of prior sun exposure. So he's got a lot of what look like freckles or solar lentigos really sort of throughout his back. So this kind of tells me this individual probably spends some time out in the sun. But he also has what are probably more depigmented patches. So this is probably the most difficult differential diagnosis to make when you're thinking about, is this non-segmental or idiopathic vitiligo, or is this melanoma-associated vitiligo? So I'm going to help you kind of tease out how to make that diagnosis. Clinically, these patients will present to you with a history of acute onset. So within the last couple of months, they noticed a spot, and then all of a sudden, it's just been taking off. Usually with non-segmental vitiligo, they'll get one spot. They may develop another spot, but it's more of a gradual progression. Not always, but it's more of a gradual progression. These patients are usually older. So we talked about in non-segmental vitiligo, they usually present, they can present at birth or childhood, but usually in their 20s. These patients are usually presenting to you late, around 50, 55 years old. And there's no areas where there's no history of Kebnerization, so no history of trauma-induced lesions, and usually there's absence in where we normally see non-segmental vitiligo in areas of friction, so around the eyes, around the mouth, along the wrist, where we tend to encounter a lot of repetitive friction. No family history, and the treatment, we'll talk about this more when we go into treatment for all these conditions, is usually camouflage. What we're seeing here is the chest, and we're seeing small guttate, right? Guttate-like, hypopigmented, maybe even some areas that look depigmented. The diagnosis, if you guessed idiopathic guttate hypomelanosis, that would be correct. So for this condition, usually patients are going to be more mature. It usually happens in patients more often. Who are greater than 70 years of age. It affects all skin tones. These lesions are usually small, which is helpful. I usually tell patients, I very commonly get referred these patients to rule out vitiligo. So I tell them usually, you know, these lesions, they shouldn't get any larger. If they're getting larger, then you need to come see me sooner so we can take a look at that. But for the most part, they stay small. They kind of follow the skin furrows. If you do have lesions that are near hair follicles, those hair follicles will stay pigmented. If you have hair follicles that have lost their pigment, then that's a little bit more suspicious for something else going on. But for the most part, patients don't really require treatment. A lot of times they're just seeking reassurance that there's nothing else going on. For some patients who do want treatment, I usually just emphasize photoprotection. And some individuals in our practice will freeze some spots to see if they can get some of that color back. But really, it's reassurance. So we're going to go back to our case. It's a 65-year-old who consults us for discoloration that's been going on for 6 months, more noticeable in the summer. He thinks it's getting worse. Given what we just talked about, what do you think is going on? How many of you think it's cutaneous T-cell lymphoma? Show of hands. No one. Okay. How many think it's non-segmental vitiligo? I see a couple of hands. A couple of hands here. Great. How many think it's tinea, versicolor? Couple of hands. Yep. All right. Melanoma-associated leukoderma or vitiligo? One hand, maybe. Okay. And then last is idiopathic guttate hypomelanosis. Okay. This is actually melanoma-associated vitiligo. Okay? So let's talk a little bit about melanoma-associated vitiligo. It actually occurs in patients more often in advanced stages, but it can also occur in the setting of treatment, so immune checkpoint inhibitors. It can occur in 3% of all cases when patients have already been diagnosed with melanoma and they've gone back to see how many of them presented with vitiligo, up to one out of five actually had presentations of vitiligo before the onset, before the diagnosis was made. So the pathophysiology of melanoma-associated vitiligo is thought to be related to the anti-melanoma immunity that is not only targeting the malignant melanocytes, but can also, maybe because they have similar markers, will also target normal melanocytes. It's thought to be affected by CD8 T cells, and again, it's unclear if the pathomechanisms that cause vitiligo and melanoma-associated vitiligo, if they're similar or different than non-segmental vitiligo. So again, talking about a little, how do we try to differentiate this? And sort of really get a sense that there's something else going on beyond idiopathic or non-segmental vitiligo. Well, the patient had acute onset, right? It started later on in life, and there was no family history. And if you take a look at his skin, there usually you can see areas of repetitive friction involved in vitiligo, and not to say that it can't be, it can be there, but collectively the history suggests later onset vitiligo and acute progression, which would make me suspicious. If it is seen in the setting of immune checkpoint inhibitors, sometimes those changes can occur several months after treatment. In one study, the mean was about 9 months. And again, it's very, very hard to sort of differentiate between idiopathic vitiligo and melanoma-associated vitiligo. So again, I'm just showing you pictures because this is hard, right? This is hard. It looks, for all intents and purposes, as non-segmental vitiligo. So you just have to have a high index of suspicion and know sort of kind of tease out the history a little bit. So while this prolonged T-cell activation from these immune checkpoint inhibitors can lead to a favorable sort of prognosis, there are about more than 50% of patients will have adverse related side effects from this type of immunotherapy. And it can affect pretty much any body organ as shown here. So it can affect the thyroid, the skin, the lungs, the gut, the pituitary gland. How many of you, or what would you guess would be the largest organ that's affected? I just gave it to you, the largest organ is the skin. So the skin is most commonly affected when it comes to adverse events. Okay. So again, just it's actually a good sign, I would say, more often than not, when we're seeing these changes, you know, you could tell the patient, you know, this is actually a good thing. That means that your immune system is identifying these malignant melanocytes. Unfortunately, it can't really tell the difference between normal and malignant, but it is a good sign. Overall, though, the responses to these immune checkpoint inhibitors is still low. And while, you know, PD-1 inhibitors probably have a little bit of a better durable response, we see better responses with both CTC, with when you're combining two immune checkpoint inhibitors. And this is just a patient who we saw who actually developed vitiligo. So how many of y'all would offer treatment for the patient? Patient's really bothered by it, and how many of you would say, well, yeah, let's go ahead and consider treatment? How many of you would consider treatment? That's reasonable. I think it's reasonable because it can be very distressing. I actually just had to, just this week, refer one of my patients to a psychiatrist because it was really affecting her daily life. That's all she thought about. She kept thinking that she was seeing new spots. So I think it is reasonable. Most people, though, would not necessarily treat it the same way that you would. Sorry, how do I go back? Sorry, well, I can just talk about it. But most people wouldn't treat it the same way that you would non-segmental vitiligo. So with non-segmental vitiligo, usually I'll think about what is the extent of involvement, right? Is it affecting more than 10% of the body surface area? Or is it less than 10%? If it's less than 10%, we're thinking about topicals, maybe targeted narrowband UVB. If it's more than that, then I'm thinking full body phototherapy. If there's activity, then I'm thinking we need to maybe add some steroids. You don't necessarily want to treat with the usual modalities for non-segmental vitiligo because theoretically you can suppress the immune system that's actually helping to treat the malignant melanoma. What we usually recommend is just camouflage therapy. So that's something that I think there are instances where some people will treat, but for the most part, I try not to treat, try to walk them through them, walk them through the process, and we talk more about camouflage therapy. All right? Okay. So the next case is a 58-year-old woman who consults the clinic, or is consulting you, for a one-year duration of hyperpigmented patches on both cheeks, okay? So what we're seeing here is, I would say, some mottled pigmentation, right? We're seeing a little bit of hyperpigmentation, maybe some areas with a little bit of hypopigmentation. So you can see there's a black arrow showing an area of hypopigmentation, the red arrow showing a little bit more hyperpigmentation. So I just want you to think about what is your differential diagnosis based on what we're seeing. Hopefully it includes melasma, pigmented contact dermatitis, drug-induced hyperpigmentation, exogenous ochronosis, or PIH, post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation. So I want you to think about that a little bit, and then we're going to go through each one of these and talk a little bit about how do we differentiate between them. So for each one of these conditions, what I want you to first notice is how similar they look. But there are also some differences, and we'll go over that in the next couple of slides. But distribution is going to be very, very important when you're trying to determine differences between facial hyperpigmentation. So what is the diagnosis? What are we seeing here? We're seeing that we've got some involvement of the malar cheeks. We've got some light brown reticulated patches. We also see some involvement. I don't know if y'all can make out that there is probably some hyperpigmentation above the eyebrows, and as well as the upper lip. Okay, so hopefully you guessed that the diagnosis was melasma. This is melasma. There are three patterns. There is the central facial pattern, so it can affect the forehead, the malar cheeks, the bridge of the nose, that's very important, the bridge of the nose, as well as above the jawline. Okay, so then we have central facial pattern, which is pretty much involving all those areas. You have the malar pattern that's just affecting the cheeks, and then you have the mandibular pattern. What is the most common pattern that you'll see, probably find in clinic? Is it central facial, malar, or mandibular? How many think it's central facial? Great, yes, that's it, central facial. You're more often gonna see patients presenting with all three sites of involvement. And I think because that's the more common presentation, sometimes it's difficult to make the diagnosis when you're seeing the malar pattern and the mandibular pattern, but it can be limited in some instances. What I want to drive across to you today is that melasma, while it is a disorder of pigmentation, more activity of the melanocytes, we're now sort of understanding it to be a type of photoaging skin disorder. When you look at it under the scope, there's a lot of changes that are very similar to what we see in photoaging. So you have solar elastosis, you've got thinning of the basement membrane. So what ends up happening is those melanocytes are actually dipping into the dermis. The skin is so thin, so that pigment becomes more obvious, okay? We also see that it can affect the vasculature. So that maybe, I don't know if you guys also know that sometimes melasma can be associated with telangiectasias. And it's sometimes difficult for me to know whether or not, especially for patients who have maybe lighter skin, is this rosacea or is there a rosacea along with melasma if they have reticular pigmentation? So we are seeing more of that being reported. So it's really important when you're thinking about treatment to really target all the paths that are involved. So this slide is just, if you're here for my next talk, we'll go over it more specifically, but for the most part, the melanocyte is not acting alone. There are a lot of cells that are involved. So we talked a little bit about the keratinocytes. Well, we didn't. The keratinocytes, when you encounter UV exposure, that keratinocyte will in some ways set off an inflammatory response that causes the melanocyte to become active. Endothelial cells also release cytokines that cause increased sort of telangiectasias. Fibroblasts increase melanogenesis, so they increase the production of melanin. Mast cells, we still don't really understand how it works, but we also think it contributes to melanocyte proliferation. And then sebocytes more recently are thought to be important in the distribution of the lesions. So there's a lot of stuff that we're now learning about melasma, but for the most part, it's not just about targeting the melanocytes. It's about really sort of trying to treat all pathways. So the retinoids are going to be very helpful, because what do retinoids do? They kind of help with collagen turnover. They help with that solar elastosis. We're trying to get thicker skin, so hopefully the pigment doesn't look so obvious. And then, of course, you know, starting with photoprotection, right, to prevent the insult, that inflammation from starting this entire cascade. And then we'll see that tranexamic acid is very important, because it actually acts at more than one of these pathways. Next, diagnosis. What we're seeing here is more hyperpigmentation that's affecting the forehead as well as the temple area. This one's a little bit more tricky, but this is actually pigmented contact dermatitis. Okay, so pigmented contact dermatitis is usually something that I see not infrequently get called melasma. But when I see melasma, I don't ever really see it so high up to the hairline. Usually it's going to be sort of above the eyebrows. There'll be some skip areas. And the temples are not necessarily involved, because there is a little bit of a shadow that sometimes provides protection from the sun. So the distribution of forehead involvement all the way to the hairline and the temples, there sometimes can be pigmentation elsewhere on acrocytes, but for the most part it's going to be on the upper portion of the forehead, the temples. You want to think of a pigmented contact dermatitis. And some of the chemicals recently implicated include topical minoxidil. Okay, so if you have a patient with a curious, maybe you're thinking melasma, but it doesn't quite fit, especially if it's localized to the top of the forehead, maybe ask a little bit about what they're using. Geraniol is a more of a cosmetic product that has also been reported to kind of cause pigmented contact dermatitis. And then DCP, I don't know how many of y'all still use it, but we usually use it to treat warts. But that's also been reported to cause this entity. And how would you treat it? You want to stop the offending agent. And like melasma, what you're probably going to be trying to do is start agents to kind of help lighten the skin, like hydroquinone, and then photoprotection. What we're seeing here is maybe a little bit of a different color, right? Hopefully you all can see that there's a little bit more of a gray-blue discoloration compared to the brown that we're normally used to seeing with melasma. I want you to also notice how far it extends. It's hard to see, there's a little bit of a shadow, but it does extend below the mandible. Melasma won't do that. Melasma will usually stay above the mandible, because that's where the sun hits. So this is drug-induced hyperpigmentation. Okay, so if you're seeing hyperpigmentation that's kind of crossing the mandible, that should be suspicious for something other than melasma going on. It's usually slow onset. It can sort of incur gradually over time. Tip of the nose is another place that I see drug-induced hyperpigmentation. So while melasma likes the bridge of the nose, if you have tip involvement, that's not usually what we see with melasma. You want to start thinking about probably other causes, like a drug-induced cause. These areas typically do not present just on sun-exposed sites on the face. So you'll want to look for other areas to kind of help make the diagnosis. And this is just a list of drugs that are implicated. I have seen this happen with Plaquenil for a lot of our patients who are taking Plaquenil for lichen planus or lupus. This is kind of where I see it more often. And again, the treatment for a lot of these hyperpigmentation orders, stopping the offending agent and then maybe adding a skin lightening, photoprotection, same as melasma. So what we're seeing here is a distribution that favors what condition that we just talked about? Melasma. I heard someone say, thank you. Melasma, right? But it looks a little bit more, especially on the photo to my left, a little bit more darker, right? So this is two cases of exogenous ochronosis. And the reason why I like these photos is because the distribution is going to be the same as melasma more often than not, because that's what we're treating patients with. So the history is going to be really important here. If you're starting to see worsening disease on areas that are typical of melasma, that should be a sign that perhaps the treatment is actually the problem, not the melasma itself. So in those instances, it's really important to stop the drug, and then we'll go over treatment in just a minute. And I just wanted to, I'm not going to belabor these two too much, but I just want to show that these are also conditions that come up in the differential for facial hyperpigmentation. What you'll notice is that there's hyperpigmentation, the photo to my right, right below the jawline, okay? This is not an uncommon presentation of acanthosis nigricans. Okay, so acanthosis nigricans sometimes will get confused with melasma, but remember, melasma likes to stay on top because that's where the sun hits. Below it, there's usually a shadow, and so I'm looking for other sites of involvement for acanthosis nigricans. Can anybody guess what's going on the picture to my left? You're right. Poikiloderma of Savant, right? I'm just kind of showing you, again, this is where the distribution becomes so important. And you can also see other kind of signs of photo-damaged skin. So now how comfortable do we feel about making facial hyperpigmentation disorders? Hopefully you're feeling pretty comfortable, right? So this is where it's really important, again, the distribution, just kind of knowing the distribution can be really helpful. All right. So let's go back to our case. How much time do I have? Let's see. Oh, we're getting close. Okay. So what do we think is the diagnosis here? How many think it's melasma? How many people think it's pigmented contact dermatitis? Drug-induced hyperpigmentation. Okay, great, I see a couple of hands. How about exogenous ochronosis? Post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation. I think we're all unsure. It's exogenous ochronosis. Okay, this is a case of exogenous ochronosis. So there's two types. There's an autorecessive form, and then there's the exogenous form. The autorecessive form is thought to be due to a deficiency in homologistic acid oxidase. There are predisposing factors. It's not just hydroquinone, but you want to think about this for people who are maybe getting certain types of peels, and it's getting worse. You can also see this with Plaquenil or hydroxychloroquine. And the other thing is, usually patients are not necessarily practicing photoprotection. So for all of my patients, I tell them, hey, we're going to start you on this medication, but it's so important because we'll learn about some of the reasons why we think exogenous ochronosis occurs. But part of it has to do with they're not practicing photoprotection. So if you're not practicing photoprotection, strict photoprotection with hydroquinone, that is a risk factor for developing this condition. So the pathogenesis, most likely, there's two theoretical reasons. Some suggest that maybe with higher concentrations, hydroquinone may actually cause, stimulate tyrosinase. And then the other is that there's local inhibition from homologistic acid oxidase by hydroquinone. And when you are not practicing strict photoprotection, the sun and its byproduct can actually lead to that pigment that we're seeing. So that's why it's so important for patients when they're on it to practice good, strict photoprotection. What patient would you think is most at risk for developing exogenous ochronosis? Do you think it's low concentrations used for a longer period of time, higher concentrations between 3 and 4% used for a longer period of time, or increased frequency of use? A and C, B and C, how many think A alone? B. C. Okay. D. A couple of hands, great. And then E. It is actually D. Yes, yes. So now what we're seeing is there are a lot of patients who are coming in, buying over-the-counter products that are 2%, don't know how to use them, not practicing sun protection, okay? And so this is what we're seeing causing a lot of this exogenous ochronosis. So it's not necessarily the high doses. It's easy to get the lower doses, and they're putting it on several times a day. No one's told them that they also need to protect from the sun. And so just keeping in mind that it's not just high doses anymore. We're seeing more and more patients come in with these lower concentrations, using them without any guidance and without sun protection. So when to suspect, I just wanted to kind of re-emphasize the history of chronic hydroquinone is important. It's not responding to treatment. There's also, when I've seen patients who I'm a little bit worried might be developing exogenous ochronosis, sometimes they get a little bit of confetti-like pigmentation. I don't know if you all have ever seen confetti-like hyperpigmentation in areas where they are applying the hydroquinone, and that to me sometimes it gets me a little bit concerned, so I'm actually usually transitioning them off hydroquinone, and I think I have a photo of that coming up. So on dermoscopy, what you can see, dermoscopy can be pretty helpful if you're thinking about this. You'll see reddish-brown clods. That is what the red arrow is trying to show you. You'll also see that those red-brown changes can obliterate the follicle, which is what the black arrow, I believe, is trying to show. And then the yellow is more showing that confetti-like depigmentation that we see. So if this is a nice, image, because it shows what melasma looks like. It's just a bland, like hyperpigmented reticular network. But under dermoscopy, you're going to see a lot more bright kind of red-brown color if it's something else like exogenous ochronosis. And this is just kind of what histology shows. Okay. So it is very difficult to treat exogenous ochronosis. So you definitely want to catch it early. And it can have, you know, if you think about why patients are coming to us in the first place, because they're bothered by these brown spots, when you have to tell them, oh, sorry, it's the medication, that can be hard sometimes for patients to hear. So the treatment is challenging. Definitely want to continue the offending agent. You want to emphasize the importance of photoprotection, because we know there's probably a byproduct that's there that can cause worsening of that condition. Some people will try to treat it with chemical peels. The problem is that the pigment is usually deep, and a lot of these topicals are just not going to be able to penetrate that deep. There have been some instances where lasers have been used, but you know, you can encounter some side effects. So this is the same patient that was actually treated with both Q-switched NDIAG and erbium MEAG resurfacing. So they sort of did both, and she's got good improvement, but you can see there's still a little bit left. So those are some treatments that you can offer patients, but the most important thing is just to sort of be mindful of when it's happening so you can discontinue it early. Okay. So I think we already went over those. We'll go ahead and talk a little bit about I just want to spend some moments talking about what determines our skin color. So our skin color really is the result of activity, right? So activity of the melanocytes, the quality of the pigment that's produced, the quantity of melanin that's produced, but it's not the result of the density of melanocytes. So it's really, I think, important for us as skin experts to really promote that all skin types are beautiful. We want to make patients feel comfortable in their own skin. And I think this is really important, especially for women with skin of color, because they tend to be the highest consumers of these skin lightening agents that we talked about that helps to kind of treat a lot of these hyperpigmentation disorders. And part of it, I think, may have to do with some of the individual cultural, or even societal pressures based on what we consider to be the ideal skin type. So has anybody ever heard of the term colorism? Is this new to anybody? Or if so, I'm going to just try to define it quickly and then tell you how this works. But colorism is actually thought to be, interestingly, more problematic within certain groups of community. Okay, so it's a bias or prejudice or discrimination really against individuals who maybe have darker skin tones. And in my community, in the Latino community, there was a research study done where patients were really felt to be treated differently. They felt like it really hurt them, especially those who had darker skin complexions, in terms of just getting ahead. There is a lot of data supporting that those with lighter skin types do actually do better in terms of higher educational attainment, socioeconomic status. So there is a lot of data to support this. Their perceived discrimination was also higher for those. So these are things that patients are shaping their lived experiences. Industry in about 2020 really started to address this, I think, in a more meaningful way. And so what we saw is in that 2020, Johnson & Johnson announced that it was no longer going to sell products marked to reduce dark spots that were widely considered to be skin lighteners. And L'Oreal pledged to remove the words fair from labels. But it's still going to manufacture these products. And I think that's fine, right? Because the whole goal is to really make patients feel comfortable in their own skin. So for patients who do have hyperpigmentation disorders that we talked about, it's really important for us to have access to these medications for that reason. So what can we do as skin experts? We want to really, when we have patients that come to us talking about concerns about their skin, we want to be able to evaluate the patient, determine that there is actually a pigmentary dermatoses that we can actually see. And if there isn't, we want to sort of think about the cultural context in which the patient is asking for the lightening treatment. We want to ensure that we're using the treatments appropriately. We don't want to encourage the products for use of overall whitening. When possible, push for regulation. And then, most importantly, further the notion that all skin types are beautiful. And I think we have some time for questions.